if you missed the memo, it is the first Sunday of the month, and that means several things around here. It means we take up our collection for our benevolent fund, and that's what these little offering envelopes are up here for. I noticed many of you taking advantage of those. It also means that we will participate in communion a little bit later on. And as a way of hopefully making that the centerpiece of what we're doing on this particular Sunday, we elected long ago to move our sermon early. So if you're wondering why I'm up here and why it says, not a typo, sermon does in fact go right at this particular point. We have been working our way through a series that I'm simply calling The Way of Wisdom. I'm happy to report that several of you have acknowledged that this is rubbing off on you a little bit. And I like that. That makes me as a preacher feel pretty good, that we're seeing some wisdom principles that they're starting to click and starting to make sense a little bit. And it does. There's a part of me that wonders, why do churches not do this more often? But I'm happy to report lots of really cool stories coming from you guys. You've heard every preacher ever probably say this, but it's true. You learn so much more preparing to preach a sermon than you're ever actually able to give out to the people. It's been a great encouragement to me as well, going back through some of these minor prophets and some of these wisdom principles, and I hope it has been to you. One young lady told me this morning that she and Habakkuk are kindred spirits, and perhaps you're identifying a little bit with what's going on there with Habakkuk as well. So we've been on this path of wisdom in the Proverbs and in the minor prophets and kind of seeing how those dots connect. And so today we find faithful patience again. We sort of prefaced it last week in chapter 1. We're in chapter 2 this week. If you haven't found it yet, I'll give you just another brief moment to find Habakkuk chapter 2. My 11-year-old daughter found it well ahead of time and marked it with her 12. Did I mess that up? Is she 12? She's 11. She's 12. I think she's 12. You're 11. I was right the first time. Ugh! In any event, she marked it ahead of time. Maybe you did the same. But page 1602, if you're with me, but Habakkuk chapter 2, as is my habit, let me read this text so that you can follow along a little bit. Let me give you the basic outline of what's about to happen here. Habakkuk said last week in chapter 2, verse 1, hey, I'm going to wait and see. And then we're going to see the Lord begin to answer. And his answer is going to come in kind of five little stages, five short little two or three verse vignettes, and it's about judgment. You'll remember from last week that Habakkuk is saying, whoa, slow down. God, I wanted you to do something, but what I didn't want you to do was the Babylonians upon us. Like, that's, no. And so now God is going to be saying in chapter 2 what's going to happen to those Babylonians, right? So chapter 2, verse 1, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. And here it is. The Lord answered me. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who sees it, who reads it, excuse me. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, and here are these five now woes, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them, because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink, you pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them, for the blood of man and a violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. And finally, what profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. So woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, who says to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it's overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Father, thank you for Habakkuk 2. Hard words to read, words of judgment upon a nation, and yet at the same time, words of judgment upon sin in general. This morning, Lord, as we look and we seek to understand, like Habakkuk did, help us to be standing at our watchpost, attentive and waiting and eager and listening. As you answered him, Lord, so you're answering us. Father, thank you for using your Spirit to inspire Habakkuk to pen these words so many years ago so that all could read, so that all could understand. Help us today to be among those who have read and understood, God. Thank you for your providence. Thank you for your provision. Thank you for your great power. And we pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Not a normal text this morning. There's a whole lot of woe in there, right? What is this, preacher? Well, you'll see. Contextually, last time we were together, we said a couple of things, and I hope they're sticking. I hope they're meaningful to you. I hope they were encouraging to you. Top of that list there, it's okay to tell God you're confused. There's a whole group of people out there in the world, and I don't quite get where the idea comes from, but there's an entire group of believers out there in the world that think, well, I mean, I can't ever complain to God. Well, I mean, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And we saw Habakkuk really did a good job of not crossing the line. He complained, as it were. He expressed his confusion to God in a way that still was reverent and still was humble and still was honest, and yet was still pretty emotional. He poured out his heart before God, and that's okay so long as we don't cross that line. Habakkuk gives us a good example of how not to. David, in some of his Psalms, gives us a good example of how not to cross that line. And then the last point that I made, here's Habakkuk choosing to be faithfully patient on the watchtower, right? But really, the one who's ultimately been faithfully patient is God himself with his people, right? And we could go back through the entire history of the Jewish nation, and we saw last week little timelines and pictures and whatnot. The Jewish people have kind of been a hot mess for a long time. And we had just three kings. And when were we supposed to have kings in the first place? And one of them hardly counts. And two of them were, right? David, great David. Yeah, but start looking into David's life a little bit. And Solomon, mighty Solomon, wisest guy that, well, yeah, but, right? And then it all fell apart and God was faithfully patient. The kingdom divided and God was faithfully patient. The northern tribes became an abject mess, worshiping idols, and God was faithfully patient, but he did tell them there is an end. There is an end. You can only sin for so long, and there is an end, and in 722, that end came along. The southern tribes, they kind of waffled a little bit. Sometimes they were okay, sometimes they kind of weren't. And along came Josiah, and things were looking pretty good, and then they weren't again, and in 586, God brought an end with Nebuchadnezzar. And so we saw Habakkuk complaining just before Nebuchadnezzar shows up. Habakkuk is complaining. He's looking around him and he's going, we're kind of a hot mess, God. How long are you going to just sit idly by and watch as injustices are heaped up upon people? And then God says, all right, I'm going to do something about this. Fear not. Not because Habakkuk complained. But he clues Habakkuk in. He says, I'm going to do something about this. And we said last week that maybe the cure is worse than the disease. I'm going to send the Babylonians in to fix this thing. And Habakkuk goes, wait, you're going to do what? No, you don't understand, God. That's going from bad to worse. Like, these people right now are at least Jewish people, and they're messing things up, and they're bad. But my goodness, you're going to bring the Babylonians? No, you can't do that. And then he says, and we saw last week at the end, all right, I'm gonna look and wait. I'm going to be faithfully patient. I'm going to wait, and I'm going to see God. We don't know how long this takes. We don't know how much of a gap of time there is in here between verse 1 and verse 2, and I'm happy to report to you, maybe it was quick, but more realistically, it probably wasn't. And we know this. Those of you that have been following Jesus for very long, it doesn't usually. When you pour out your heart in some really, really big way, it's not often that you get an immediate answer. And so when we read simply in verse 2, and the Lord answered me, I don't want you to take that to mean that that was immediate. There may have been a significant amount of time that passed here, and Habakkuk is remaining faithfully patient. God is remaining faithfully patient with Habakkuk and with his people. Even though he is about to send his people into exile at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, we know the end of the story, that he is in fact not giving up on his people. And we talk all the time about a remnant of the faithful, and we know that when we come to the New Testament, there is this original root of David that we get grafted into as the very people of God. So God's not abandoning them. God will remain faithfully patient. Habakkuk is remaining faithfully patient. But here's the good news. His faithful patience is going to pay off in this great, great revelation. And to put it really, really bluntly, as simply as I can, it's this. The Babylonians are as good as gone. They haven't even come yet. And God's already telling Habakkuk, I know, I get it. You're not telling me anything I already know, Habakkuk. They're terrible, awful people. And fear not, I am, as the sovereign king of the universe, going to use them for my purposes. But that doesn't mean I'm approving of their brokenness. It doesn't mean that I'm going to, like, get rid of you guys and elevate them. It doesn't mean that I'm going to change my standards. It doesn't mean I'm going to violate my very character and turn a blind eye to their own wickedness. It doesn't mean any of those things, Habakkuk. It's going to be okay. And so he says to him, write the vision. Make it plain on tablets. Now, it's funny, who would have ever imagined just a few short years ago that a preacher would have to explain what a tablet is? Dear young people, tablets aren't always digital devices, right? Like big cell phones. Once upon a time, tablets were just like slabs of clay. And you'd get yourself a nice fresh slab of clay, maybe an art class, young people, maybe an art class. You've had like fresh clay and they peel that plastic off and it's still kind of squishy and you can like write in it even if you wanted to. That's what people used to use long ago. They would get these tablets of clay and you would get out your little stylus. Yeah, that's not also just for electronic things. And you would carve into that letters and to be real careful about it and get it wet and clean it up and everything. And then they would lay them out and they would dry. And when they became dry, they actually became pretty durable, permanent records, so long as you don't drop them and break them, fairly permanent records. And so he's telling Habakkuk here, write this vision. I'm not just going to give you this vision, Habakkuk. I'm instructing you right now to write this thing down. And I don't want you to just write it down in any old way. I want you to make it plain. I want you to presumably make big letters so he may run who reads it. The idea is, it's almost like billboard kind of language. He's saying, I want you to write this in such a way that people can very quickly process and digest it. I don't want you to use tiny little script. I don't want you to use fancy flourishes that some people can't read. I want you to just basically put it out there in big block letters for everybody to read. This is important, Habakkuk. This is not a time for embellishments. This is not a time to be secretive. This is not a time to practice your fancy calligraphy. I want you to just be blunt and bold and put it out there on tablets so even a person who's running by could quickly read and digest the nuts and bolts of this. Then he says to him in verse 3, for still the vision awaits its appointed time. Okay, it hadn't happened yet. You're going to have to be patient. You're going to have to be faithfully patient, Habakkuk. It hastens to the end, and it will not lie. It's going to happen. But you're going to have to be faithfully patient. In fact, he puts it really bluntly. If we're looking for an encouragement to be faithfully patient, guys, it's in 3B. If it seems slow, wait for it. It's kind of become the punchline of jokes these days, right? Somebody does something stupid, and you're like, what is happening? And somebody goes, wait for it, and then the punchline happens or whatever. Now, here we're seeing really, truly, if you get to a moment, Habakkuk, where you're going, come on, God, you told me the Babylonians were as good as gone, but they're not. They're here, and they're terrible, and they're... Wait for it, Habakkuk. Patience. It will surely come. It will not delay. But God, it seems like it's delaying. No, no, it's my time, not yours. I know when this is going to happen. I know exactly how this story plays out, and I'm giving you, Habakkuk, a little window into this. It's like the fog of the future. I'm gonna wipe that away just a little bit and let you see through a little bit of what's coming, and you need to rest in that. You know, the ancient Greeks believed, we talk all the time about hindsight is 20/20, right? You've heard that expression. The ancient Greeks, when they talked about walking through life, we use that metaphor, walking through life, a journey through life, and all that sort of stuff. The ancient Greeks actually kind of had it right. They said we're walking through life backwards. Because the best you can ever see in front of you is just a tiny little bit. That's the most of the future you can ever see. We can see really well where we've been, but just only barely where we're going. Here, it's as if God is saying to Habakkuk, hang on just a second. He turns him around a little bit. He says, see that? That's coming. Okay, now, when you get frustrated, you rest in that little vision I gave you. You rest in that little glimpse of the future that I gave you. You take your comfort in that. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. And then it starts to get a little confusing. And visionary language is sometimes confusing. Apocalyptic language is sometimes confusing. And I want to help you out here a little bit. Verse 4, he says, behold, his soul is puffed up. His soul, who are we talking about? Throughout the rest of chapter 2, we're going to talk about some unnamed Babylonian king, just the king of Babylon, but he represents Babylon. So when we say his soul is puffed up, functionally we're saying the Babylonians as a nation are an arrogant people. Oh, okay. So every time you read that, if you just glance through, his greed is as wide as Sheol. Woe to him who heaps up. Woe to him who builds. Woe to him who makes. This him that we're talking about throughout here is a generic king of Babylon, but he's representing all of Babylon. So what God is saying to Habakkuk is, these people that I'm about to unleash upon you to clean house and to bring judgment, because you have deserved judgment, you are broken and you are in sin, dear Judah. You're going to be judged. In fact, I promised you long ago that if you don't obey my laws, I'm not going to let you stay in this land. And he's about to take them out of the land for 70 years. I'm going to get you out of this land. But I'm also going to judge these people because they're broken too. So verse 4, behold, his soul is puffed up. This is standing in for all of Babylon. It is not upright within him. So Habakkuk, you're right. These are bad people. These are broken, messed up, awful, terrible people. Their souls are puffed up. It is not upright within him. But then he compares that on the other hand, but the righteous shall live by his faith. So the difference is one who puts his trust in something else, and we'll see a whole bunch of somethings that the Babylonians put their faith in, as opposed to someone who puts his faith ultimately in the only secure object of our faith. Let me say this, guys. Every single person who's ever lived has faith. Please don't ever let college students argue with you, oh, well, you know, I'm just not a person of faith. Some people, I'm a man of science. No, that's fine. Every person ever is a person of faith. Those are easy things to prove. My favorite way to do so, I usually have these conversations with people while seated. I do it on purpose. We sit down, we have these conversations, because then I can turn to them and say, I noticed when you walked in the room that you did not inspect thoroughly your chair. I noticed that there was no, you simply, dare I say, had faith that that the chair would support you? Because there's something within us as human beings. We are by design people who understand, we are people of faith. We have to. Can you imagine how literally crazy you'd go if you never had faith in anything? If you had to test everything? Most of us can't even read the names of the medications that get prescribed to us. Let alone actually, can you imagine if a doctor says, here, take this, and you say, whoa, 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 I don't have any faith in you or medicine, so I gotta look all that up, I gotta do all that clinical, I gotta do it. Like, you can't, it's just not possible. Can you imagine the dread and terror you would live in if you had no faith in the buildings? It's gonna fall. We're people of faith. We are every single one of us people of faith. So what I want you to see in verse 4, the righteous shall live by his faith. We, all of us, are faith people. It's the object of our faith that matters. Do we put our faith in the living God of the universe, or do we put our faith in chariots and horses? Do we put our faith in money and paycheck? Do we put our faith in our own abilities? Do we trust in our armies? Do we trust in our heritage? Do we trust in the living God of the universe? Everyone is a person of faith. The problem is today more and more people are choosing to invest their faith in themselves. Believe in yourself. Well, I mean, what? Okay. Behold, that person's soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by his faith. And then verse 5, we're going to unpack verse 5 a little bit here in a moment. I hope you're going to see another connection. We've talked about these links where scriptures are connected to scriptures. I hope you're going to see another one of those in just a moment. But for right now, just the basics. Verse 5 says, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. And so there is this metaphor going on here. Wine, what's wine mean? Who's this traitor? Hold that thought. His greed, now we're back to the Babylonian king, his greed is as wide as Sheol. What's that mean? Well, like death, he never has enough. So Babylon is super greedy, never enough. Gobbling up nation after nation, land after land, conquering city after city, just like death, never has enough. Right? We've said many a time, everybody's got to do at least two things, right? One of them is die. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. How dare you gather up other people and call them your own? Well, that's what Babylon has been doing. So this first section here is God saying to Habakkuk, you're not wrong. The Babylonians are terrible people. You're absolutely right. They are despicable people. But I want to give you just this little window. I'm going to turn your shoulders around for just a second, Habakkuk, and I'm going to let you see the future just a little bit. And I want you to faithfully wait for that. Be patient for that. And write it down so that other people can be encouraged by that. Because trust me, the Babylonians are as good as gone. In fact, he says in verse 6, shall not all these people that have been conquered and whatnot, shall not all these take up their taunt against him? With scoffing and riddles for him and say. So what follows now is taunting. Well, you can almost picture when it's all done, when all the dominoes have fallen, the king of Babylon thinks, man, I am the man. I have got this. Look at all these kingdoms and everything. And then the last domino falls and Babylon falls. And now it's as if there's this great chorus of all these people that have been conquered. And they're taking up this taunt against him, right? The classic childhood, nah, 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 nah. It's a taunt against him. They're saying, yeah, you thought you were a big deal. You thought you were the king of the hill. You thought, but wait. And they're going to categorize in 5 ways the great, great evil of Babylon. And I want to go through these, and here are your 5 kind of basic labels. Again, please remember my point today is not to unpack every single little detail of Habakkuk. We're really trying to keep our focus on this principle of faithful patience. So Habakkuk is being admonished to be faithfully patient, with God. This is going to happen. You haven't seen it yet, but trust me, this is going to happen, Habakkuk. Number one, Babylon is correctly accused of crushing others to build their own empire. So look at verse 6b. He says, "Woe to him," that's Babylon, "who heaps up what is not his own," for how long? "And who loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnants of the people shall plunder you." So he's correctly accusing them. God is saying, look, you have heaped up what is not your own. You have destroyed, crushed, absolutely devastated other peoples. And there's all kinds of them. Not just Judah. There's all kinds of people groups that Babylon, which started out as basically just the city of Babylon in southern Iraq, well, central-ish Iraq. And then it began to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And it gobbled up all these other nations and all these other peoples, destroying, crushing on its way to making itself great, to building up its own empire. And then interestingly, look at these words that get repeated. The end of verse 8, "For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them." I find that fascinating. God is going to judge Babylon for the blood of man. See, there's something about humanity, and I don't care what PETA says, and I don't care what the pro-choice crowd says, there's something about humanity that God says is sacred. Did you catch this? He's judging them for the blood of man. Now, wait a minute, preacher. Most of those people that the Babylonians are conquering are broken, evil, terrible people. They're just getting what's coming to them, right? There's something about humanity. We're made in the image of God. We are image bearers of God. Now, don't go too far down that road. Some people out there say, well, we're all God's children. Well, I mean, in the sense that we're all created, we're God's children, but children's family language, and God reserves that for people that are his. But we are, every one of us, created by God. And so there's something about the blood of people and the shedding of that blood and the violence done to the earth. Who created the earth? God created earth. It's not so much violence done to these other nations. It's that they're made in my image. You're performing violent acts against this earth that I created and to the cities and all who dwell in them. So this judgment isn't just because you're politically bad guys. You're like, you're conquerors and nobody likes God. No. It's much bigger than that. It's that you're shedding the blood of humanity and you're doing violence to my created world and to these cities and those people. So number one, Babylon will be defeated. God's promising their defeat because of this brokenness, this crushing of others. Verse 9, he begins a second one. He says, "Babylon, you also are exploiting the wealth of others." So in verse 9, he says, "Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm." Now this is really cool, guys. At least I think it's really cool. I hope you. Do you remember, I hope you do, do you remember a few weeks back when we were having a conversation about Obadiah? And I said to you that Obadiah is preaching against, he's got this vision against the Edomites. And we talked about how there are these narrow little river valleys and that the trade routes went through there and the Edomites would set up way on high, right? And they said, you build your city on high like the eagle and you think that no one can touch you. Well, I, God, will bring you down from there. Those words were penned around maybe 200 years before these words. In the 200 years that have happened since then, that's become such a common figure of speech. You build your house like an eagle up there in his nest. I'm going to tear you down. It's become such a common figure of speech that it gets used right here. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house to set his nest on high. See, the thing is, Babylon's out in the middle of the plains. There's nothing high about Babylon at all. Babylon is on flat ground. Babylon's like right smack dab in the middle of Indiana. It's just flat earth. Maybe Iowa, even flatter. Kansas, even flatter. Babylon is out in the middle of flat plains as far as the eye can see. And so you say, set their nest on high? What are you talking about? Because God used Obadiah before to give this powerful metaphor of the Edomites who literally were on high and them being judged, now it's become kind of a common figure of speech. And it doesn't just show up here, it shows up in other later prophets, and it actually shows up in other literature, non-Bible literature of that time period. People just started using it as a figure of speech. You who set your nest on high, you think you're above the rest of us. Well, you're going to get yours, right? Interesting. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. For what purpose? Why are you exploiting other people? Well, for your own safety, to set your nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. So you used everybody else's stuff to build your own house. It's as if you can imagine, instead of, it's the summer and the harvest is coming, and instead of planting and harvesting, you're just going to sit back and wait until everybody else starts harvesting, and then you're just going to go steal their stuff. Well, wait a minute. There have actually been people in the history of the world who've done exactly that. That's been kind of their primary strategy. Incidentally, probably the most famous of them, the Spartans, right? The real Spartans, not the ones from up north in God's country, the actual Greek Spartans. That was their theory. True story. Sitting down there in southern Greece, they looked around and they said, you know, there's not a lot of farmland. Hard. It's really hard to farm in Greece. It's really rocky and rough. But look at all these other people around us. They're all farming. You know, if we invest in military training, we could just go take their stuff, whatever we wanted. That's what they did. Really true. There have been people in the world, not just the Spartans, there have been others who've done that. It's kind of what Babylon is doing here. He's saying, woe to you who gets evil gain for your own house. You're looking around you at all these other people, and you're taking their stuff to make yourself better, to make yourself more safe, to make a great name for yourself. And in so doing, what you've really done, verse 10, is devised shame for your house. You forfeit your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. I love that message. What he's saying there is, you went and stole somebody else's stones and you built your cool house with it. You stole somebody else's wood and you framed your cool house with it. But trust me, it's as if the stones and the wood themselves are crying out, thief, liar, cheat. And God will bring judgment. If walls could speak, they would be crying out to Babylon, you stole us from others who worked hard. And God will bring judgment. Verse 12, he jumps into the third. He says, Babylon, you are also terrible. Habakkuk, you're right. Babylon's no good because they're enslaving and abusing other people. Verse 12 says, woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. There's that idea again that because we're made in the image of God, something about the shedding of blood. Woe to him who builds a town with blood. History teaches us that you've got a few choices with what to do with conquered people. You've probably never thought about this. I hope you've never thought about this because this is a sort of twisted train of thought. But if maybe you've ever pondered history a little bit, you've sat down and you've said, okay, so I just conquered tens of thousands of people. Now what? Well, history gives us a few options. Some people in history have followed the let's just kill them all route. Very few people, Genghis Khan's one of those people, very few people have done the let's just kill them all route. And there's a really basic reason for that. Dead people don't pay taxes. So, I mean, really. So most of the world's conquerors have said, well, you know, we probably shouldn't just kill them all because, you know, that's silly. What most of the world's conquerors have done is said, let's enslave them all. Let's make them our slaves. What the Babylonians did is actually went one step further than that. The Babylonians said, yeah, I want to enslave them, but the thing about enslaving people is they tend to get mad about it. I mean, you know, who wants to be a slave? And they tend eventually to rebel. They riot. They revolt. So what Babylon did is they said, yes, we're going to enslave you, but actually first we're going to pick you up and we're going to physically relocate you to a totally new part of the world. And then we're going to enslave you. Because then when you think about rioting and you think about revolting, you're going to look around you and you're not going to know anybody else. You're not going to know the good hiding spots. You're not going to know where you can get supplies. You're not going to know where you can put up defensive structures. You're not going to know how to escape. You're going to be in a foreign land. How are you going to revolt in a foreign land? It's incredibly expensive, but that's what happens. So when we read in the book of Daniel about Daniel and Ananias, Azariah, and Mishael being taken away, it wasn't just the Jewish people that the Babylonians did that to. They did that to all kinds of people, physically relocated them, and then enslaved them. And so God here says to them in verse 12, "Woe to you who builds a town with blood. You've enslaved all these people and you're abusing these people. You're building cities on iniquity because you're building cities on the backs of slaves. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." There's hope in that. It's hard to think about very long. We're uncomfortable thinking very long about slavery and building on the backs of slavery. And many of you have visited places in the South, visited old plantations and things, and you know full well these places were literally built on the backs of slaves. And that's hard for us to think about. And God lays it out there for Babylon and then instantly breathes this life in verse 14. "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Man, how much water. You can't even imagine how much water. How much glory. Can't imagine that either. Okay. And then he says to him, fourthly, Babylon, verse 15, "Woe to you who makes your neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness." What are we talking about? It's not that Babylon is like literally force-feeding alcohol to their slaves so that they get drunk and then they fall down naked and then they're laughing at them. It's not that, but that's the picture. That's the metaphor. The idea is it's as if you invited them to a party only to get them drunk, only to then laugh at them as they stumble and stammer about in their drunken state. Right, that's the idea. So what's actually happening to them? What's literally happening to them in the case of Babylon is they're demoralizing them. They're demeaning them. You need look no further than Daniel to see that. Y'all got to bow down and worship this great idol. And if not, we've got this big old fiery furnace over here that we've got stoked up into which we're going to chuck you. Right? You got to eat our foods. It's only by a direct, remember the book of Daniel, it's only by God's direct intervention that Daniel doesn't have to eat these pagan foods and defile himself by eating foods that God has commanded him not to eat. It's only because God granted Daniel favor with this jailer that that happened. They are demoralizing people, dehumanizing, you might even say. Metaphorically, they're just making your neighbors get drunk in order to laugh at them. "But you," verse 16, "will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision." So nakedness, but not just nakedness, you're also displaying to the world that you're not one of God's people. "The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory." You think you're a big deal, but that last domino falls. And here, remember, this is a taunt. All these other people, they're taking up this taunt against Babylon. "You who thought you were a big deal." I told you last week, and I know it's a little hard for sometimes us to wrap our heads around, historically, Babylon's not a big deal. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, everyone knows the name Nebuchadnezzar. You could start wandering the streets of America and say Nebuchadnezzar, and most people will give you a little flicker of recognition. What do you mean they're not a big deal? Like, historically, they're not. They don't even make it 100 years. They don't make any great contributions to much of anything. They're just not a big deal. They're a big deal only because, ironically, they're recorded in the pages of Scripture. Verse 17, "The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them." That's interesting. God said a minute ago that it's His creation, right? "Dear Babylon, you're tampering with my creation, and I'm going to judge you for that." Here in verse 17, "The violence done to Lebanon," Lebanon is 100% famous for one thing, trees. And so what he's really saying here is, you cut down all these trees to build your evil structures. You cut down all these trees to make weapons, probably handles, spears and arrows and things, for weapons with which you did violence. And the second half of the verse, "the destruction of all these creatures." I made all those creatures too. You're killing all these animals, probably horses in combat, also all the livestock that have to die to feed his armies that go out and expand his evil will. and, here it is again repeated, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities and all who dwell in them. So God is correctly, rightly claiming ownership over all of it, guys. I made this earth. Don't mess with it. I made these trees. I did not put them there for you to tear down and turn into weapons of destruction. Now, don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying, well, become tree huggers and God made the trees, can't cut down the trees. No, he's upset that they're cutting down the trees and using them for evil purposes. He's upset that they're not, that they're destroying beasts. We should all be vegetarians right there. So, no. He's upset that they're killing these creatures to advance their evil agenda. And, of course, that they're killing people and doing violence to the earth and to the cities and all who dwell in them. Babylon, you're in trouble. And then finally, verse 18, he gets to the much more famous one, Daniel and the big old idol and the fiery furnace and all that. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? Think about how backward that is, right? What profit is an idol when its maker shaped it? The maker shaped you. But we do it the other way around. We literally, we humans, we pull things out and we make them and then declare them our makers. Imagine the nonsense of that. Behold, your God. You just put that there. You just made that. What are you talking about? It's silly. The Bible uses strong and dangerous and mocking language to discuss these things. Look at this one. I love this one. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. So I said a moment ago, every single one of us is a person of faith. An idolater, ultimately what they really did is they put their faith in the maker of the idol. They put their faith in themselves. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, or to a silent stone, arise. Other prophets, I love, the prophets are great, man. That you've read these stories. They say, why you got to tell your God to wake up? Like, is he on vacation? Is he sleeping in late today? Like, why? People would do, can you imagine? People in the ancient world would beat their chests to wake up their God. And if that didn't work, they'd pull out sharp instruments and they'd literally make little bitty cuts on their wrist, hold their arms to the heavens, bend their elbows a little bit so that the blood then drips off their elbows to wake up or to get the attention of their God. And the prophets of the true God of the universe go, y'all dumb. Like, what are you doing? Can you not see? Well, they say it this way too. They say, what does it say about your God if you have to feed it or it'll die? Who's actually God in that scenario? Right? Like me and the goldfish. Functionally, I'm the goldfish's God. If I don't feed it, it will die. But no, look, behold, the mighty goldfish. Like, what is wrong with us? Guys, we are people of faith, and we just, because of our brokenness, will place it anywhere but where it belongs. But praise God, he reaches in and rescues us out of our own nonsense, our sin, and our brokenness. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, wake up. Can this teach? Behold, like, have you not noticed? It's just a chunk of whatever overlaid with gold and silver. There's no breath in it. It's a dead, lifeless thing. How dumb can you be? But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth. I want you to notice, guys, did you catch it? This vision actually begins and ends with great hope. And I want to go backward a little bit. I told you to hold the thought of verse 5. I want to go backward a little bit, and I'm going to invite you to find Daniel. We want to look here at this verse in chapter 5, or excuse me, verse 5 in chapter 2. Before God even got to all of the woes, back in verse 5, where he was saying to Habakkuk, you're right, these guys are terrible, he said this curious line, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. Oh, that was weird. weird. What is that? Well, lots and lots of scholars say, well, this is a metaphor. And it's a metaphor for the idea that wine is a traitor, which means that you're going to get drunk on power. The king of Babylon is going to become drunk on power. And in the same way that once you get drunk, you know, you end up doing things you wish you hadn't done, so the king of Babylon is going to get too drunk on his own power, and he's going to end up doing things that he wished he didn't, and it's all going to come collapsing around about him. And maybe it's a metaphor for that. Maybe that's what's going on there. But I want you to look specifically at Daniel. Find Daniel, if you will. I want you to look specifically at Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5, the book of Daniel is kind of weird. It's broken up not chronologically real well. Daniel chapter 5, I don't want to read the whole thing, but I do want to skim through it, so it'll be helpful if you've got the text in front of you. Daniel chapter 5 is the end of Babylon. So everything we just read in Habakkuk that's promised to happen to Babylon, in Daniel chapter 5, like they're actually getting there, to the end of Babylon. And it's this king, Belshazzar, and he's got this big old feast. And verse 2, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his ancestor, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem be brought in, that the kings and his lords and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Belshazzar's throwing a party, and they bust out the wine. He's like, this is pretty good, but you know what would make it better? Go get those temple cups that my ancestor Nebuchadnezzar stole from the temple of God, and we're going to party like it's $5.99. We're going to party using God's sacred instruments here in our pagan city. And so they did. The text goes on, talks about how they did. And then verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall in the king's palace opposite his lampstand. And the king saw, and the hand wrote, and the king's color changed. And his thoughts alarmed him, and his limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. And then as time unfolds here, somebody goes, hey, you know, we've got this guy, this dude named Daniel, and he's kind of old now. But back in the day, he used to interpret dreams and stuff. Maybe bring that guy in. So verse 13, Daniel was brought in before the king. And he verifies that you're the right Daniel. And hey, are you the guy? Yes, I'm the guy. Here, I'm going to give you all this stuff if you'll interpret this. In verse 17, Daniel said, keep your gifts. Give your rewards to another. But I am going to read the writing. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. How come? Habakkuk has been telling us, in order to judge God's people's sin. God used your ancestor Nebuchadnezzar for his purposes. Everything great about Nebuchadnezzar is because God allowed it. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all the peoples and nations and languages trembled and feared before him. But verse 20, his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly. And then it goes through some of the problems that Nebuchadnezzar has. And then finally, verse 24, then from his presence the hand was sent and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. And this is the interpretation. Can you imagine this? Being the half-drunk king of Babylon, you've just seen a hand write, a phantom hand right on the wall, and you don't know what it says, and Daniel comes along and says, this is it. God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And that very night, Belshazzar was killed. Now go back to where we were in Habakkuk. Wine is a traitor. I think, guys, that what Habakkuk is being told here is exactly what will eventually come true in Daniel chapter 5. That because you got drunk, and especially because you had the audacity to use temple goods, things that were for the sacred worship of the true God of the universe, in your drunken party, we're done. Game over. The end. Right now. and Daniel comes in and announces judgment. History teaches us that while that was happening, literally while Daniel's in that room interpreting the handwriting on the wall, the armies of the Persians have diverted the river up north so the water level has lowered enough so that the troops can walk through waist-deep water and get underneath the grate that goes into the city. And they are literally, while Daniel is interpreting the vision, in the middle of running through the city, and everybody hates this guy so much, the Babylonian people go, ooh, an invading army is here. Are you going to get rid of our king? Yeah, he's that way. It's a revolution without even being a revolution. Belshazzar is so despised by his own people that they're taking up a taunt against him and pointing the way. He's over there. That's his palace. Man, go get him. Get rid of that guy. Long live the Persians. We're happy to be Persians. Habakkuk, you're being told, man, God turned your shoulders around for just a second and he let you see what the future is going to hold. And Daniel chapter 5 kind of spells it out for us a little bit. And Rembrandt here again captures it just after the Renaissance. I like the look on the king's face there. I'm not quite sure that he's captured his color changed, but I like the look on his face there. What? I want you to notice as well, though, the vision began with hope. The vision also ends with hope. And this is the much more famous bit of it, right? Look at verse 20, the very last verse. But the Lord is in his holy temple. That's all caps Lord. That's Yahweh, the tetragrammaton, right? The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So this is not like the actual temple that we're talking about here. This is probably a reference back to Psalm 11:4. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. This is something that would have been used for temple worship services. So Psalm 11:4, people would have heard when you walked into the temple for a Sabbath service or for whatever, you would have heard these words, the Lord is in his temple, the Lord's throne is in heaven. Like, this physical temple that we've got here is just a reminder of the actual presence of God up there in the heavens, the Creator, the King, the Lord of all that is. And so what more fitting way can Habakkuk, who was probably an official temple prophet, what more fitting way can he breathe hope into this than to remind the people of these words that they hear every time they enter the temple? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see and judge. And then Habakkuk adds, let all the earth keep silence before him. So all of Babylon's clamoring, all of their stammering, all of their shouting, destruction, violence, curses, all of that brought to silence in the presence of the one and only God of the universe. How do we respond to that, guys? The answer's already been provided for us. The answer was provided back in verse 4. Babylon's soul is puffed up and not upright within them, but you and I, the righteous, not by ourselves, but the redeemed, the called out, those who have been made righteous, declared righteous by Christ, we shall live by faith. That's the comparison. These people, these Babylonians, doing all these terrible things. Well, I could never do that. You know what? If you stop living by faith, you absolutely could. What? No, yeah. I've said before, every one of us is capable of being Stalin, capable of being Hitler, capable of being Belshazzar, capable of being Nebuchadnezzar. The righteous shall live by faith. That's our response, guys. Don't walk out of here and think, yeah, stupid Babylonians. Well, maybe think that a little bit. But walk out of here more committed than ever to what God encourages Habakkuk with. If it seems slow, wait for it. It's going to come. You've read the end of the story. We know how God works this thing out. It's going to be okay. In those moments when it doesn't seem okay, it's all right to pour out your heart to God. But we step back in faithful patience and we say, I will live by my faith. Okay. Now, some of you might note, I'm sure Brett has been wondering, preacher, you didn't give us any really big words today. What's happening? So what's happening? Here's next week's. Next week, we're going to talk about theophany. What's that? It's a cool word. You'll like it, I promise. Father, thank you for the opportunity to study Habakkuk a little bit. Thank you for the opportunity to see, rarely do we get the opportunity to see a vision announced and then its mostly, anyway, fulfillment there in Daniel chapter 5. And so you announced judgment upon Babylon to Habakkuk. You fulfilled that judgment upon Babylon in Daniel chapter 5, and you've preserved all of that perfectly so that we can read and we can understand as you commanded Habakkuk. Put it plainly. Write it in such a way that even somebody running by could read it and make sense of it. And the sense of it, God, is simple. You're the King. You're the Lord. You're the sovereign God of the universe. And you will lift up nations and you will put down nations. And you will raise up even pagan, broken, wicked nations to serve your purposes and to advance your kingdom and to bring judgment and to manifest your glory. You're the King, Lord. You're the Creator. You're the Sculptor. You're the Designer. You're the Architect. You're the Author. You are all of those things that we are not. And we as people of faith, Lord, help us. God, help us to keep our faith firmly rooted in you. As tempting as it is to put our faith in ourselves, as tempting as it is to put our faith in science or technology or our neighbors or our parents' faith or our anything else, so tempting, God, help us to put our faith, to keep our faith, to ground our faith, to live our faith only in you, the one true God, the sovereign Lord of all that is. Father, thank you for this opportunity. God, thank you for a chance to worship now in another way. As we've worshiped in song and we've worshiped by hearing your word and worshiped by thinking through and worshiped as we've encouraged one another, thank you that we now have the opportunity to worship by taking up an offering. I thank you that on this day of the month we take up an offering for our benevolent fund and for our regular funds as well. And I pray, God, that no one would give out of a sense of putting a notch in their belt, but that we would be cheerful givers and givers who seek your glory and the advancement of your kingdom, not recognition for ourselves. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for those that are coming, where we'll have a chance to sing some more and we'll have a chance to observe the Lord's Supper together. Thank you for this day that you've given to us, Lord. And I pray these things in the name of Jesus.